Okay, Ozzy, how about you? What are your early recollections of you working at Wagner Music?
Well, I was in high school, and we had a little local garage band type of thing. And our keyboard player, a guy named Jerry McGee, lived roughly in the neighborhood and was a good friend of Rod Fraser's. And he knew a lot of those guys. So after school, I had just gotten my driver's license. We started hanging down at the music store. And then eventually we started helping out with things. Same thing as Howie was saying. And then I started fixing chords and things like that. And eventually I was getting paid. I'm a drummer. But
you were fixing...
I've got a fairly decent technical background. But I was making guitar chords, fixing the... Well, taking a piece of wire and a jack and assembling the chords so that people could have chords to plug into. So I was making mic chords and guitar chords, fixing broken mic chords and guitar chords, and we were fixing Beatles too, the Super Beatles. Putting new speakers in, taking bad ones out, rewiring up the cabinets, disconnecting the horns, and cutting out the watchdogs, which was this little tiny capacitor, basically, that limited the power in the amp. Now, I wasn't that much of a technician, but once they told me cut this thing out, I knew what to do. So I worked in the back room mostly, working on whatever could be fixed as much as I could do. And I did deliveries here and there and helped with a lot of the moving stuff and taking things down to some of the shows that were set up and helped set them up.
Were there issues with the speakers in the Super Beetle amps?
Well, the speakers themselves were pretty decent. You know, as loud as the music was, there was, like anything, there's a lot of blown speakers. And everybody, it doesn't matter what kind of amp it is, people are going to blow them up. But especially then, you got, I think we sent a set down to one of the shows that Hendrix did, and he blew up 8 Super Beetles.
Eight.
He was playing through 8 Super Beatles, and when they came back, they were all blown. These were all solid-state amps at this point, and they were loud. They were big amps, 410s in the Super Beetle, and there was what?
412s.
412s?
Yep.
412s.
Yep.
What was that, an 18 in the...
In the bass amp, yeah.
In the bass amp, yeah.
Goodman. A Goodman 18.
Does anybody know how many decibels they would push out?
Enough to...
Right on the threshold of pain. Yeah, like maybe 128.
Yeah.
You know, because I think 130 is the threshold of pain.
They enough, were, what, 200 for, amps? Were they 200 amps?
Yeah, 200. Yeah, I think they were,
yep.
200 amps.
Yeah.
The output was rated differently in RMS than it was in a tube amp.
Yeah. But 200 amps is... fairly powerful for a guitar.
Yeah, enough that it made me eligible to wear hearing aids now, because I can remember that people would be at a concert and say, "Hey, Wags, we blew a speaker," and I'd go on and stick my ear up there to hear if it was buzzing or not. I think that maybe had a little effect in my hearing. I don't know, but, yeah.
Let's talk about keyboards. Denny, you're a keyboard player. What do you recall about the Vox keyboards?
Well, you know, these were compact organs. They, you know, most of the compact organs tried to do something that would try to simulate Hammond-type sounds, because that was definitely the preference of most serious keyboard players, unless you played piano, and Vox never really made anything that was really a piano instrument. They always made just organ instruments. So... with these various different incarnations of the Vox organ, people remember the Animals, House of the Rising Sun, and, you know, that was a great sound for a combo organ, but, you know, it really sounded kind of cheesy, and it didn't really have that big, fat R&B kind of sound, but you got by with it, especially if you broke your foot once, like Greg did, and you just didn't want to have the huge, heavy duty unit around. You did whatever you could to try to make it sound the best as it could, but they were unique to certain different styles of music, but didn't lend themselves well to, say, you know, serious rock and roll or R&B, but They were okay. They got by.
Was it 96 tiers? Wasn't that a fox?
Yeah, Question Mark and the Styrians, one of those awful, awful legendary songs that had the repeated little chord sound. We did a couple interesting things. We took Cordovox cabinets, which had a rotating horn like the Leslie cabinet that you hook up to a Hammond, but they were portable and they're pretty small. They didn't actually have a horn in it. They had a rotating drum, and we'd stack those on top of the frame for the Beatle amp cabinet. And for Greg and I played piano, and Greg played organ. You sort of, kind of, a little bit got that sound, but we got by with it. They made a couple fairly elaborate multi-manual organs, and one of them that I could never really quite figure out, which was called the Baroque, which I don't think I ever saw one anybody actually use professionally, but I think there was one ordered and it came into the store. There was the dual manual electric organ, which was a dual manual Continental. Then the Baroque organ had harpsichord, and it's kind of like RMI piano sounds, but they weren't very good, and it was really expensive considering. Yeah. I think they were $2,300, which seemed like an extraordinary amount of money back then. I don't think the store ever really sold one.
That had a double keyboard, right?
Yeah, both two manuals and a. Most of the Vox organs had the reversed key colors, so the white keys were black and the black keys were white. I could never quite figure out why the Baroque had only a left-hand bass section that you could play a separate output for bass. If you wanted to play bass with your left hand, you could do it, but otherwise it was pretty useless. And, you know, the Vox amps, you know, for me, playing a Wurlitzer piano most of the time that I had the Vox amplifiers, it wasn't too bad, you know. And for me, the horns were okay because it helped the piano sound. But just, you know, for kind of edification, all the amplifiers that the Beatles played were all made and manufactured in Kent, England. And those patents and all that stuff became kind of portable, and they went over to the United States. And as Paul said, all these solid-state amplifiers were manufactured in Sepulveda, California. Mm-hmm. And many of the endorsement groups, like the Castaways and the Stilroven and some of these other bands that used them, including Paul Revere and the Raiders, they didn't really like them all that much. So the guts got all ripped out of most of these things, and all it really was just the crosshatch grill cloth and the boxes that were left. You know, the Paul Revere and the Raiders had JBLs and absolutely everything. And when I went on tour with them for Whirlpool as a part of Paul's dealership with Big Daddy Wiggs, I got these little anecdotal summaries from each musician in Paul Revere and the Raiders that I fed back to Vox at Whirlpool, and they were lucky that they were able to even keep the Paul Revere and the Raiders, but they did whatever it would take to keep the endorsees using their stuff. The organs were never considered to be by any serious musician anything other than just a substitute for a Hammond, and not a very good one at that.
And the popular brand was the Continental. Was
that the Continental was the one that you saw the most, the single manual. The dual manual, once in a while, there was a group from California called Pacific
Gas and Electric.
And Pacific Gas and Electric, when they came out, had one of the dual manual Continentals, and I knew most of those guys and talked to them. And it was like you used it because it was easy to carry around. You could set it up in 15 minutes.
Wasn't there a Jaguar?
The Jaguar was the bottom.
The Jaguar was a little smaller.
That was the bottom line, the least expensive one, which didn't have the reverse keys on it, I don't think. Oh, maybe it did. That also had a little bass section on it. But the Vox Continental organ is the one that we remember the most from the Zombies and the Animals. You know, their top 40 hits and stuff were primarily all Vox Continental organs. And those were the older organs that were built mostly in Kent, England. They didn't change it very much. The amps were very different, but the organs were pretty much all the same. There wasn't much change. The stands and the keys and the controls and everything on the organs were virtually identical to the ones that were made in Great Britain.
Does anybody recall what the cost of a Vox Continental organ was back in the late 60s?
I think the retail was about $700.
I think the Continental was $800, and the Jaguar, I think, was $600.
Yeah.
There was also some accessories that Vox made. They had a rhythm box that was like an electronic drummer that didn't really sell. They also had a multi-instrument thing, an octave divider, where if you played trumpet, you could put a pickup on your trumpet, and that would allow you to have play your part, and it would give you a harmony above or below, and you could change the amount of the harmony. It could be like two steps up or one step up. Yeah, the Bandmaster. And
that was the model that did that?
And then they also had the Vox Wah-Wah pedal. Was probably their most popular accessory. And that basically, if you wanted an effect, the Vox Wah-Wah was the one right after you bought a Fuzz Tone, the Vox Wah-Wah pedal.
Okay. Now, we haven't talked much about guitars. Paul, did you sell guitars too?
Right. Our main brand of guitars was Gibson. Gibson and Epiphone.
Yep.
Along with Harmony.
So you didn't buy the Vox guitars?
Well, we did. We had a
We had them on display.
Yeah, yep. Right. Well, they had a Vox had a promotion one time. Had I bought a little bit more, I could have got back in those days. It would have been a 1968 Lincoln Continental. Had I bought enough guitars, amps, and band instruments. There was a guy that by the name of Bill Page that played with Lawrence Welk. Bill Page was a If you go to the old watching Lawrence Welk, he was a reed man, heck of a sax player, man. So he went on his own, and what they were talking about is these it was an amplified band instruments that King Instruments. King used to be a big name in band instruments, trombones, and I remember from high school and that. But anyway, King collaborated with Vox, and they had these. It looked like big band. You have your music stand with the light on it, you know, where you have your music. Well, copied that with amplified it. So you could amplify instruments. And like Howie said, and they had a switch that I remember with my cornet. And you'd have to buy a Vox cornet because it had the pickup on it. And you'd hook it up, and you'd hit a switch. And while you're playing the trumpet sound, it would be sounding a baritone sound, you know, boom, boom, you know.
Yeah.
It was quite an innovation. It was quite a deal. That was one of the deals with that we put on a big concert with Bill Page and his electrified band. They were touring the United States, and I remember the Vox people came out and were wanting us to do that, and I finally said, I don't want to be facetious or anything, but I said, who's Bill Page? And he said, who's Bill Page? You know, big shot from, well, he was with Lawrence Welk. I said, oh, okay. So then I found out. It's like after years of listening to this fabulous guitar player, blues player and all that, I found out his name just a few months before he died, and that was Stevie Ray Vaughan. I loved his guitar playing, but so I wasn't much for names and all that kind of stuff.
So you had guitars on display. Which models did you have on display?
Oh well, we had some. They're all that didn't last long. In other words, the guitars were bad, and we ended up shipping them all back to the factory that they finally gave us credit for them. That we got rid of the Vox guitars.
Where were the guitars made?
Italy.
Italy.
They were an Italian brand. But our main was Gibson.
Okay.
Yeah, we sold a lot of Gibson.
Tons of Gibson.
Didn't Mike Elliott teach at the store and also do a lot for you as far as your relationship with the Gibson guitars and doing seminars and stuff? Was that later on?
That maybe was with Levon.
He might have been later. Yeah, on. No, he was. That was when it went to Suburban Music,
okay.
And then Levon was when Mike Elliott started
that,
in
right,
them.
He held on to the franchise. Mm-hmm.
Although I have to mention to you that Bob Foshaw, the original guitar player from the Castaways, still has one of the Vox Star Stream 12 strings that he's converted into a 7-string guitar, and it's his primary instrument today.
Hagstrom. Yeah. We also had the first eight-string Hagstrom basses.
Yeah, we handled Hagstrom.
Wow. All I know is that Steve Miller still has, I sold him a Gibson Les Paul. And in fact, one of my relatives were having a wedding and Steve's band was playing for it or something like that. And he's still got that old golden.
I wish I would have kept
it. That's the one that Lonnie Knight got from you. Broke the end off it. You guys repaired it. Steve Miller got it, and he still has it.
Oh, okay.
Lonnie Knight did the old slam the amp thing with it when he got it from you and brought it back.
There's a lot of musicians in town still have the equipment that they got at Big Daddy's.
Yep.
I mean, I know I've got a couple of guitars that people were leaving. They wanted to sell it. So, yeah, if the store didn't buy it, I bought it, and I got a couple of them that are worth a lot of money now.
Wow, good for you.
We have an email that came in from Susie Mork from the
Colorado
Amendment.
Yep. Yes.
She lives in Aurora, Colorado, just outside Denver, and she emailed Denny and said this about Wagner Music. I was always in awe of all the music equipment in the store, and he always let me pay on time credit. We never had much money, so that was really nice. Got my ES-335 TD Black Beauty there. I sold it to my cousin in Minnesota, and it still lives on. Susie. That's a Gibson, I think, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Very nice one.
Black Beauty.
Whole Susie. Awesome.
Yep. Yeah, she has a recording studio in Colorado, too.
She does, at her house. Yep. And
wow.
Yeah, matter of fact, the 19th Amendment got together, I want to say maybe 8 years ago, and they all got together out there and played and recorded it.
Yep, we have a copy of that recording.
Cool.
Now, Paul, you also sold all the guitar strings and all the accessories, like Ozzy was talking about, making cables and that stuff. You had a complete line of all the various different gauge strings for the bass players and the guitar players, and I don't mean to interrupt, but you know, there was kind of a culture in the store that was kind of typical of the 1960s for a while, you know, the old sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And a lot of us, and I'll speak only for myself, used to imbibe more a little bit in a little weed and a little, you see, get high every once in a while, get a little buzzed in the store. It was a part of what happened with, you know, the rock and roll culture. It was just kind of normal. We weren't insidious or criminal or never thought we were doing anything really bad, but some of the experiences that I had when I worked in the store for you were really kind of a treasure to me now, because I remember some experiences like smoking some really good weed and getting a really good buzz on, kind of thinking about going downstairs to the retail store in that condition to work again. And as I walked down the stairs, you were behind the counter as happy and as convivial and smiley as you ever are, but likely it had the same stuff that I smoked, and standing in front of you were six nuns from St. Margaret Mary's Church School buying mandolin strings. And you just functioned and acted like nothing was wrong at all. And I turned around and hightailed it back upstairs and couldn't manage it because it just was too much of a trip.
Oh, you bring back memories. Except that one. I don't recall that. All I can say is that what you're speaking of, I'm very extremely grateful for having the opportunity to imbibe, thanks to a guy by the name of Dean, David Dean.
Oh, yes, David Dean is no longer with us.
From the Still Roven, because I remember when I would imbibe in my scotch and water and beer and all that and say, you guys are crazy doing that. You're nuts. You're absolute. And David said, Wags, try it. You'll like it. Well, thanks to him, I did try it for several weeks and ended up liking it. But the good news of all this is that thank God for that stuff, because in 1971, which wasn't too much, it landed me in treatment for alcohol, because they didn't treat. They asked me, what are you doing here? And I, what are you doing? It was a last stop, Heartview up in Mandan, North Dakota. I says, well, I smoke pot. You what? I says, I smoke pot. And they said, well, the nurse, you know, taking me in, and she says, we don't do anything about marijuana and that. She's, we don't treat that. I said, well, I'm thinking, thank God, get me on that plane, get me back to Minneapolis. And she says, well, do you drink? And I said, oh, yeah, I do that too. Okay, you're in. So so I ended up in, thank God for treatment, and And it's because I truly believe being introduced into a different way of life. Because after all, you have to remember, I turned 30 when I was in the music business. And back in those days, you did not trust anybody that was 30 That's or correct. Older.
That's right.
And so,
right. I think that line came out of a movie.
I think you're right.
Now, I'm looking at your photo here outside the store. You know, first of all, I should ask you, when did you become Big Daddy Wags?
You know, that's a good question. And I don't know who gave me that name. I don't know if it was it Mallet? Maybe Bob Mallet? Yeah, well, there was a baseball player. It's the only way I can relate. There was a baseball player, Daddy Wags, that played for Cleveland. And I don't know, but I
could be in that 1980 Tracks article, which was partly an interview.
Was it?
Okay, I'll look at there.